Welcome to the Open House podcast site, available at openhousecommunity.com.au.
Let's have a deliberate look at the way our lives are being pushed, shoved and remodeled without us being fully aware. Adam Alter is Assistant Professor of Marketing and Psychology at NYU's Stern School of Business. In his book Drunk Tank Pink, Adam has collected a grab bag of eye-opening social experiments that will change the way you look at colours, shapes and names, and their power over our every thought and emotion. Adam was born in South Africa, was educated here in Australia, and now works in the US. Adam, thank you for your time. Let's start with a culture question. Does our culture play a significant role in the influences you outline in your book?
There are distinct patterns within each environment. I think each of the three countries I've been to at least has its own burdens of the past. They're all distinct. They're all a function of history, the different histories in each place. I think the thing that I noticed very quickly was not so much the very big issues that you see in different cultures, the very big differences, but more the really small ones that you don't think about until you arrive in a new culture. Just the inflections, the way people say things, some of the word choices, the vernacular, all these very minor features that you think wouldn't matter much end up shaping all sorts of outcomes. For me, just communicating with people in the U.S. when I first arrived here was quite tricky. I always felt there was a beat between us.
Yeah.
And I had to bridge that over time. And it happens naturally. You get used to the different culture, but these small differences do have big effects early on.
Some of us find our vocations by accident. Was yours an intent? Was it the answer to a specific question? Or was it just an open line of inquiry and you thought this might be worth a go?
It was a string of accidents, actually. I started out studying finance, and then I started studying law, and I almost finished a law degree. And then I got very interested in psychology, and I pursued a PhD in social and cognitive psychology in the U.S. at Princeton University. And one of the people I just happened to meet and work with was studying some of the issues that form the basis of a lot of what I do today. So I would say, you know, if you're curious generally and you're looking for inspiration, that can come along, and that's what happened with me. I became quite fascinated in the one area, and that led me into this intersection between psychology and marketing, and that's what I do today.
Drunk Tank Pink, a specific reference. What's that about?
Yeah, it's a very strange title. It's not a run-of-the-mill title, and it's totally opaque unless you know what it refers to. It's a bright bubblegum shade of pink that came to have the title Drunk Tank Pink. And basically what happened was in the mid-60s, some psychologists in the U.S. were interested in trying to find out whether they could improve the behavior of students in schools. And they managed to get the Canadian government to agree to allow them to change the wall color in a whole series of schools across Canada. And they used a whole lot of different colors, and what they found, much to their surprise, was that when they used pink, it seemed to lead to the best outcomes. And now, since the sample was pretty small, they only had a few schools painted pink, they started to do a whole series of experiments. And they found that if you stare at this color pink, particularly young males are quite a lot weaker afterwards. And there are all sorts of interesting applications of the color. And where it actually got its name was after some prison wardens decided to use the color in some of the cells that they reserved for the most aggressive prisoners. Colloquially, these cells are known as drunk tanks. You basically throw the drunks in there overnight and let them sober up. And so they painted these cells pink, and they found that if you took the very most aggressive prisoners and put them in there for just 15 minutes, they were overwhelmed by this color pink, and they seemed to be much better behaved. They were much calmer and more compliant. There are lots of other uses for the color as well that I found quite fascinating. One of them is an American football team, basically a rugby team, painted the locker room of the opposing team at their stadium this bright pink. So at halftime, the team would go in, their opposing team would go in and come out, you know, theoretically much weaker.
Let's leap into the drunk tank, shall we? Let's start with names. Now, the name game for any parent is one of the more stressful times of a relationship, certainly in my experience. Choosing the name, I did the rhyming game. So what did it rhyme with before I gave it to my child as an epithet? But your claim is names are actually far more potent than what they rhyme with.
Yeah, that's right. There are a whole lot of different components of names that end up shaping various outcomes. Rhyming certainly matters to some extent, as you probably thought about. You know, there's a concern that people will pick up epithets that rhyme with a particular name. I talk a lot about this concept known as fluency, and a lot of my own research is on the topic. And fluency is basically the idea that just as you become fluent with a language, some words, some names are much simpler to pronounce than others. And this has outcomes, pretty major outcomes for people. We looked at how lawyers did in law firms. This is actually some work that I did with Simon Lamb and Peter Koval, who are both Australian academics. We basically looked at what happened in American law firms, how quickly people progressed up the legal hierarchy in these firms, and we found that those with simpler names, when you factor out as many other forces as possible, seem to do a little bit better. They seem to climb that corporate ladder more quickly and more reliably, especially earlier on in their careers, suggesting perhaps that if a partner approaches a new lawyer and that lawyer has a name that's easy to pronounce, there's some ease there, and that suggests that the partner is more likely to pick that person for a team or to elevate them professionally, whereas if a partner encounters someone who's got a complex name, there's some social anxiety there, and that might lead to negative outcomes. So even very small effects like the ease with which you can pronounce someone's name seems to have a very, very big magnified effect down the line.
We're fascinated with giving stuff labels, aren't we? And there's power in just what we call something.
Yeah, absolutely. There's some fascinating research looking at what happens in the courtroom. And in one of the studies, people watched, as eyewitnesses do, they watched a video of a car crashing into another car. And there's this footage of the car hitting the other car, and they're asked to memorize what they've seen, just as an eyewitness would do after witnessing a crime. And then later on, they're asked to estimate how far the cars were going when they collided. But very subtly, the researchers changed the way that that was described, the label that was given to that event. So either they were asked, how fast were the cars going when they collided? How fast were they going when they touched? How fast were they going when they smashed? And these different words had very big effects on the estimates of speed. When they heard the word smashed, they were more likely to say that the cars were going much faster and that there was glass spilled during the accident, even though there was no glass spilled.
Goodness.
So our memories are fallible, and the labels we give to various events end up shaping how we remember the very same event.
And the labels of rich versus poor, intellect versus high school dropout.
Yeah, that's exactly right. This was a classic study run in the US actually at a school, and some teachers were told that their students were bloomers. They were told that these students were expected to do very well in the coming year. They were given the special academic title of bloomer, and other students were not given that title. Now, these students were randomly selected. There was nothing special about the bloomers that distinguished them from the other students. But after a year, because the teachers believed that these students were better, were somehow more promising, they sought out evidence of that to confirm that bloomer status. And what they ended up doing was they treated these students differently. And so after a year, the students in the class that was labeled as the bloomer class had an IQ of 10 to 15 points higher on average than the students in the other class, even though there was absolutely no difference between these students at the beginning of the year. So these labels had a massive effect over the course of a year because they shaped what the teachers saw and how they approached these students.
So what's the lesson here for us, Adam? We label everything. Is there ever an appropriate label that we can rely on to be a truth?
I think so. I think what this does, what the attempt here is to get people to at least be mindful about what is normally a mindless decision. Certainly we think very hard before naming our children, and we should do, but there we don't really know what factors we should pay attention to. Part of what's going on here is I'm suggesting that these labels that are often given mindlessly should be given with a bit of care, but I'm also giving people the tools to use when they're trying to act with that care. It's one thing to know that you've got to be careful. It's another to know what these labels do. And I think these two anecdotes, the story of the courtroom with the cars smashing versus colliding and the story of these students who were labeled bloomers, shows that the sort of tone that you give to any event, that label that you use, ends up shaping outcomes in pretty big ways. It's just important to be very careful that the tone you use when you use a label is consistent with the outcome that you're hoping to promote.
Let's have a look at national symbols for a moment.
Yeah, that's right. It's interesting. So a country's flag is obviously a very potent symbol, particularly for people who have nationalistic pride. That has both positive and negative effects. It sort of depends on the way you approach the symbol. But seeing a national flag, there are two very different kinds of effects that we've seen in the literature. One effect is that people come together. So what you find is during an election that was held in Israel, if people were shown the picture of an Israeli flag, left-wing people became more centrist and right-wing people became more centrist. So they sort of met in the middle. It united them in a sense. But in other studies, we've seen that people who are highly nationalistic, particularly in the U.S., when they see the U.S. flag, they become more fervently nationalistic. So they become more fervently right-wing. They become a little bit more prejudiced. There's a sort of leakage of racist behaviors, or at least of prejudiced behaviors. So basically what this shows is just that these symbols are very potent. It's not always easy to predict what effect they'll have, but among highly nationalistic people, you can find that there's an exaggeration of that effect. But among people at large, there seems to be a sense that this national flag acts as a sort of umbrella that gathers everyone together and seems to, at least to some extent, bridge their differences.
So that's perhaps a learned response, an educated response. Are there symbols around that were designed to manifest a reaction?
You know, there aren't many. It's surprising how few there are. We've learned, obviously, to have a very strong reaction to the swastika or to money. Even currency symbols, the dollar symbol, matters a lot to us. And there's no good reason for that. The swastika, of course, started out as a Buddhist symbol, and it was a very positive symbol. There were no negative connotations until the 1930s and 40s. So I think largely most of the responses we have are learned, and there's a whole list of fascinating findings. Even Apple Computers, that company, when we see that Apple symbol, it turns out that we respond more creatively to prompts. If we're asked to engage in creative behaviors, we do a much better job of that after we've seen this Apple symbol rather than, say, the IBM symbol, since that's not as strongly associated with creativity. So I think they're largely learned, I would say, in this case.
Let's have a look now at the power of pictures and symbols on relationships, Adam. I love the story of the honesty tin in the staff kitchen.
Yeah, that's one of my favorite experiments from the book as well. It was run in the UK at the University of Newcastle in a psychology department. And what the researchers noticed was that people were coming to the psychology tea room, the break room, and they were taking tea and coffee and milk, and there was a small jar. They were supposed to deposit a couple of coins in the jar every time they took tea, coffee, or milk, and this just wasn't happening. So the supplies of tea, coffee, and milk were dwindling, and there wasn't a rise in the level of the jar. So people just weren't doing what they were supposed to be doing, which was being honest and paying for what they were taking. So the researchers realized that they didn't have the means to install a surveillance camera. There was also no reason to do that. That was a bit of extreme measure. But what they decided to do instead was to see whether they could have a sort of virtual form of surveillance acting on these people who were clearly not doing the right thing. So what they did was, for a period of 10 weeks, they alternated each week between pictures of flowers that they put up on the wall or pictures of a pair of human or human-looking eyes. And as you walked into the room, when you took the tea, coffee, or milk, either there were with these flowers above the jar and above the notice asking you to deposit a few coins, or there was this picture of a pair of eyes, just the eyes, not the rest of the face. And what they found was that people put about 2.5 to 3 times more coins in the jar when they were greeted by this pair of eyes rather than flowers, which is it's a remarkable effect. It's a very inexpensive way of surveilling people and making sure they're doing the right thing. And it basically shows the power of other people, how much we care about the gaze of other people when they're looking at us, how we feel when we're being watched or even feel as though we're being watched. So it's quite a powerful effect.
And yet that gaze can be counterintuitive. You cite the example of the Good Samaritan instinct within us all being dissipated when there's a large group of us around, say, a crime. We are less likely to act if there are large numbers of us witnessing the crime.
Yeah, that's right. That was one of the most staggering findings for me as a graduate student. In fact, even as an undergrad at the University of New South Wales, I heard about this study, and I ended up doing my PhD under the supervision of the person who originally ran that study, John Daly at Princeton University. And it was a remarkable insight. There was a terrible crime in New York City, and the claims made by various journalists were that lots of people, dozens of people, had witnessed this horrific crime. It was a personal attack on a woman, a young woman, and none of them did anything about it. They didn't call the cops. They didn't intervene. And the journalists basically asked the question, is there something wrong with these people? Is there something faulty in New York City? Is it preventing people from doing the right thing? And John and his co-author, Bib Latinay, decided that they would try to get a better sense of what was going on. They didn't believe that there was something faulty in these people. They thought it must be something about the situation. And they reasoned that it turns out you'd think that the more people see an emergency, the more they'd be likely to help, or that at least someone would help.
Hmm.
And they proposed the opposite, counterintuitively. They basically suggested that when there are too many other people around, first of all, you're not sure if you should help or whether someone else should help. So there's this diffusion of responsibility. You feel like the pressure is off. But even more, you look around and there's this tendency to try to act cool and calm at all times. And when you see other people not acting in the first few seconds, you start to imagine, well, maybe I'm misinterpreting the situation. Maybe this isn't really an emergency. And so when there is some ambiguity, often people will look to others for a signal. And because we all try to act cool and calm most of the time, we end up being confused. And so in the end, no one ends up acting, even though in their heads there's this bell ringing saying something's not right here.
Is that a cultural response? Are there other nations that can override that capacity to be cool?
There is some suggestion. It's a really good question, actually. There's some suggestion that in more cohesive or collectivist cultures that you don't quite see the same effect because individuals feel that they're all part of a single unit. Instead of being individuals who are worried about what they'll do with respect to the others around them, they feel more cohesive and they behave basically as a unit despite the fact that they're all individuals. There's more overlap between them as people. And so there is some research showing that in East Asia, for example, in various East Asian countries like Japan, you don't get quite the same effect. That the trend in the US and Australia is very strong. The more people witness an emergency, the less likely any one person is to help. But you don't see quite a strong trend in Japan.
Let's develop the affirming nature of relationship just a little further. You contend that the power of love directly affects our ability to cope with stress and pain.
Yes, yeah. Fascinating research from the University of California. Some psychologists were interested. They were working near a medical school, and obviously people go through a lot of painful and unpleasant procedures, tests and other medical procedures. And what they wanted to do was to see whether just looking at a photo of a loved one could allow you or help you to endure more pain. And they had a number of different conditions in the study. Sometimes people were holding the hand of a loved one. Sometimes they were holding a hand of a stranger. Sometimes they were looking at the picture of a loved one. And just looking at the picture of a loved one as they experienced forms of pain led them to be able to endure much more pain and to feel much less discomfort at the same level of pain. So the idea of a loved one embodied in that picture of that person, even if they're not in the room with you, is a very, very powerful analgesic or pain reliever, which is quite a remarkable effect.
I was really interested in one particular study around conformity, where people are given the choice to stand up for something they believe in and then they don't, or otherwise. Can you fill in some of the detail about your understanding of our need to conform?
Yeah, it's a very strong need. It's especially strong in Australia, in the UK, in the US. And so the classic experiment, which was run in the middle of the 20th century, was run with a whole series of people who were planted in the room to give the wrong response to a question. It was very obviously the wrong response. Mm. It was a very simple task. They were asked to look at a series of lines and to determine which of the lines, the three lines, matched a target line in length. And it was very clear that the one line, say line B, was the same length as the target line. So the right response would have been B. And yet all of these people in the room, a whole series of them, were coached to say C. Now the last person to respond, after all these people had given what seemed like the wrong response, the last person to respond was just a participant in the experiment who had no idea what was going on. And you can see in the videos of the footage that this person starts to get stressed, they start to sweat and go bright red, because they're realizing that there is a right answer. No one else is giving the right answer. They could stand up and say, this is ridiculous. The right answer is obviously B, not C, as you've all said. But the vast majority of them decide not to do that. And there are a number of things that happen. Either they convince themselves that they must have misunderstood the instructions, though the instructions were absolutely clear, or they feel that they must be misperceiving. Perhaps there's something wrong with their eyes. They're not seeing things straight. And so they start to get quite flustered about that. But what happens is, in general, they tend to resolve the situation in favor of conforming because it's just the easiest thing to do socially. There's such strong pressure that ends up being the path of least resistance.
Adam, can I ask what it is we do with your book after we've read it? Because there's so much really fascinating material in it. And yet, it's hard not to finish the book with an increasing skepticism on the fact that I am a response to the unseen world far more than I anticipated being.
I think... It's pretty clear that a lot of these effects are surprising to people. You know, that just they're intrinsically interesting, and I think they're surprising. And I think that's a pretty good goal in itself. I'd say that the goal was further than that, though. I didn't just want to educate people and give them a sense of the way the world ends up shaping us in ways we might not expect, but I also wanted to give them a sense of how they could harness those effects for better outcomes. And perhaps stave off some of them that are more negative, because you know there are two kinds of effects: some that lead us to happy outcomes and some that hinder our progress. And I wanted to touch on both of those. And some of the effects I describe in the book are positive and helpful, and some of them are a little bit harmful or hurtful. And I think by understanding them, we as individuals can behave much better. And then a lot of them are policy level or society level effects, and I think we can do a lot better. We can certainly talk about some of those later on, but That was basically the goal, to give people some tools to improve their own lives.
Adam, thank you so much for all the work that you brought to our attention in Drunk Tank Pink, and you're appearing at TEDx in Sydney in April.
Yes, I am. I'm looking forward to it. It'll be a fun event, and I'm looking forward to visiting Sydney as well. My family is still there.
Excellent. Well, perhaps we might reach out and reconnect at that point. Thank you so much for your time.
Thanks for having me, Dwayne. I appreciate it.